Without further ado, it's May 15th, 2023. Let me begin something I found interesting or amusing from the Rav. It's in the latest journal, Hakira, which has a few things on the Rav. It has his never before published what he spoke at, said at the Shloshim of Rabbi Rifkin, the Chabad Rosh Hashiva Torah V'das, and it also has lectures of the Rav, the relationship between halacha and agada, that when he taught, he used to give classes. This is from circa 1950 at in the Revel Graduate School. But you know the old joke that we all know about, that if we had a Christmas tree, there'd be all sorts of questions. Can you use, does it have to be from a real tree? How tall does it have to be? How long do you have to leave it? Is it enough to leave it 2 days, or do you have to leave it? How many nights are there? I don't even know how many nights they talk about the song. But so that's like a joke. But the Rav actually on page 30, in discussing how halacha always concretizes everything, he says, for example, if having a Christmas tree would be a mitzvah, the masachta on it would first take up how many branches it must have, what kind it must be, how it is to stand. The result would be a series of intellectual laws, a mathematized tree, an atomized tree. The concept of hadar, beauty, and lulav is almost converted in halacha to quantity. So the Rav himself, if you ever mention this and people think you're joking, the Rav himself gives us an example of how Judaism is different than the non-halachic system of Christianity, in that, you know, for the Rav, everything arises out of halacha. Halacha. Sometimes I say halacha, halacha. He, Heschel, the Rav is said to have remarked about Heschel. I was reminded of this by listening to a podcast recently on my son's yeshiva, Oraita, podcast, that Heschel was, he wrote this great book on the Shabbos, the Sabbath. If you haven't read it, it's certainly very inspiring. But the Rav is said to have commented about this book, the Sabbath, that it's a great book, but it has nothing to do with Shabbos, because Shabbos for the Rav is the lamatas malachas. Everything has to be understood out of the halacha. Simply waxing lyrical about the Shabbos doesn't work. So it's the same thing. You know, anything you have, menorah is only menorah because of the halachic discussions about that. I read this over Shabbos, or most of it. The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy. I'm actually more interested in the American Orthodoxy element of it, because these are talks from the Rav from 1939 through the 50s, translated from the Yiddish line. This just came out, and one day someone's going to write a biography of the Rav that's going to have to encompass all of this, and this is quite important. But relevant to what we were discussing, on page 210, the Rav confesses to something really interesting. This is from a talk he gave in December of 58 called The Mizrahi and the Jewish Edge, and the Jewish Dance of Eternity. Let me just read you what he says. When I came to America years ago, I felt the bitterness of loneliness, the need for companionship. I would often cry in private out of despair. When I joined the Mizrahi movement, it was not out of devotion to the cause, but because of the need of companionship. To whom could I attach myself? In the Mizrahi, I found friends who do not check each other's tzitzis. In the Yiddish, it says bodek tzitzis, or play around with bands, who know how much one can and one must demand. I must say that I found then in the Mizrahi two comrades with whom I found maintain a friendship down to the present day. So the Rav is telling us here that when he first joined the Mizrahi in the early 40s, it wasn't really about Zionism. It wasn't because he concluded that this is the proper approach. He just was fed up with aguda, as he says. They play around with bands. They check each other's sitzes. That he didn't want an environment like that. Later, he becomes the great spokesman of Mizrahi. Remember, he was never opposed to Mizrahi. I already showed you how in the 30s, when he was officially a member of Aguda, he also signed declarations for Mizrahi. But, I mean, he believed both. He was really part of both of those worlds. He could go between both those worlds. But here he tells us that it was the extremism in the Aguda that led him to Mizrahi. And once he's in Mizrahi, then I guess you could say he develops this these ideas. Mark says the comments about Hilchos Christmas, That's the shiurim I was just reading about. If there's something else, let me know. Last class, we had a big discussion. Why is it there's halacha you have to light Shabbos candles, but there's no bracha in the Gemara. So where do we get this idea? It's from the Gaonim. So the question was raised. This was a tangent over something else we were speaking about. Why don't we? Why aren't there people who don't say the bracha on Shabbos candles? We know that Sfardim don't say the bracha. Not all of them, but generally. Rosh Chodesh for Hallel Rosh Chodesh, Rav Avadya says, and other Sfardim don't say Shasani Kirsano with a bracha, Nosen Leif Koach. So I didn't really have an answer for that, but I investigated it, and it's actually Machlokas in Rishonim. If you look in the Torah, in Siman Reish Samach Gimel, he says Yesha Rim Shein Lavarichalav. There are those who say you don't make a bracha on the Shabbos candles. I don't know if anyone who doesn't, even the Ammonites make the bracha, but I have all the sources in this sefer I have. It's called Ner Yom Tov by Rav Ratzabi, because the Yemenites don't make a bracha on Ner Yom Tov candles. The difference here, as he explains, is that there's a chiyuv to light Shabbos candles. So now that we have a chiyuv to light Shabbos candles, already the Gaonim institute you make a bracha, so we make a bracha. But there's no chiyuv to light Yom Tov candles. So since there's no chiyuv to light Yom Tov candles, even though our minhag is, certainly, he argues this on the front page of the book, Asur levarechal ner shel Yom Tov, mitam safek bracha v'vatala. And in the discussion of this, he mentions all the different views. He says, by the way, the very first page, Ein makor b'shas v'gaonim v'mishnah Torah l'Rambam she'etz mitzvah b'hadlakasa v'choshekein berkaso v'af lo b'midrashim b'v'zohar. He's speaking about there's no source in the Gaonim or the Rambam or the Gemara or the Midrash that you make that you light candles on Yom Tov. He says Ner shel Yom Tov shel Yom Kippurim ein makor b'shas etc. Overloading, but he gives all the sources here on page 43. The various as a Machlokas and Tosfos about he in fact he you know the Rambam says you make a bracha on the Shabbos candles. So Ratzabi says that this is a proof against all those who say that everything the Rambam says has a source in the Gemara. Because there is no source in the Gemara, and therefore we see that the Rambam would take things from the Gaonim. So he gives all the sources here that you make the bracha, and then he says it's a machlokes Rabbeinu Tam v'Rabbeinu Meshulam if you make a bracha on the Ner Shel Shabbos, and he cites the authorities who say you don't make it, but we do make it. Now, the only difference he says is that at least it's a chiyuv to light Shabbos candles. There's no chiyuv to light Yom Tov candles. So, but still, it's not a Talmudic bracha. So you might assume that just like in the other brachas that people don't say Hashem with Hashem's name, you might assume here too, but they don't. Again, thank you, Hadassah, for pointing out Rabbi Greenwald last week. She sent me the document. It's amazing what's available online now. I should have just checked the Wikipedia, not the English. The English Wikipedia, which I checked, doesn't mention his wife, Rabbi Greenwald's wife. The Hebrew does mention a whole different biography. And it's she was a Rebbetzin. I mean, his Rebbetzin was the daughter of a rabbi. So you have the whole story there. Robert asks, I gave you examples from this book, Davening with the Rav, of where the Rav Soloveitchik changed the Nusach. Either changed it based on Rishonim, Gaonim, or changed it because he thought it was a mistake. So Robert asks, well, how was that? You know, the Rav went crazy over Yom Ha'atzmaut when people changed the Nusach with Haftar, all these sorts of things, the Matbea that the Chachamim gave us. So what's the difference? I think the difference is that Yom Ha'atzmaut, you're creating like a new service, which there's no source for. When the Rav says you should say it this way, not that way, there's no question, there's no issue here of the Chachamim who gave us a Matbea. It's there's different girsos. And when the Rav even comes up with a way of reading it, which is not like we have in our Sidurim, what the Rav is telling you, this is the proper Matbea. So it's not something new. He's not coming up with a brand new way of doing things. That I think answers it. Couple other things. I'll leave the others till later. Oh, and thank you also, Robert, for pointing out that Century Village in Boca, and also someone says in Deerfield, it's Rav Schechter who gave the Haskamah for people who can't walk to Shul to go on this bus that goes around. I think that's quite significant. And one of you, Jonas, points out that Rav Schechter says it's not because you want to daven with the minyan. If that's the only reason, stay home. But he says that people for Shabbos to stay home and not be together with Shul, then there's no Onik Shabbos. And if that's the reason, he gave the heter. But he also said the local rabbi, you have to follow your local rabbi. And finally, I thank very much Daniel for sending me the material about Revolt. It seems like it's a legend that he, well, obviously, it's not, it went through the case, went to the, it went to the Supreme Court of New York, the appellate division, and it's actually called Volk versus State Division of Human Rights, and it goes to the appellate division of the Supreme Court. There's nothing in here, if you read it, about Yiddish. And I'm starting to think that maybe this is a complete bubble myself. First of all, when I looked at the dates, Revolk is in America 35 years, 36 years. He's a brilliant person. You're telling me he didn't know how to speak English well enough that he could give a shiur in English after 35 years? We're dealing with a gaon of gaon of a gaon. So I find that hard to believe. But if you look in the case is simply that when he whether he was physically able to perform the duties of his position, he, because of his illness, he took some years off and then he wanted to come back. And maybe it could be that the Yiddish was in the background, but that's not why Yeshiva University, that they thought that he was physically incapable of performing the duties. So that was the case. And he sued them saying it was unlawful discriminatory practices against him. He was disabled in 72. He suffered a heart attack in 76, and he was on the payroll till 77. It seems that the whole thing is just, it's not true. If anyone has any other information on this, please let me know. But before we end, I want to give you a couple more things about Revolt. People are very interested in him. And I'll introduce you to a book that's not a popular book, but here it is. Elchanan Blumenthal, Trials and Challenges. Rabbi Elchanan Blumenthal published this book, published in 1994. He's an old Telzer. Then he left, he made his way to England during the war. Then he was deported because he was a German citizen. And even the Jews who were German citizens, they deported them because they thought maybe they were spies. So he was sent to Australia and he becomes a rabbi there in Australia. Then he moves to South Africa. Then he comes to Israel and he has a government job or two. And then he works at Devar Yerushalayim and he wrote a memoir. Together with articles. Here's someone. Just after about 5 years, knows English well enough to be writing articles in English. You're telling me Revolk, the genius, wasn't able to do things in English? It's hard to imagine. So he writes a whole memoir here. He even tells that when he comes to Jerusalem, he goes to meet Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel. And Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel says, I'll tell you the page. I think this is, I don't even say the page. Well, I forgot to mark the page. Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel talks about how the Rabbanim came together in Vilna. What should they do during the war? And Rav Chaim Ozer said, so let's stay here. If you listen to my classes, you know this. And Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel says, I didn't listen to him. And thank God I'm alive, because he didn't listen to Rav Chaim Ozer. But if you look on page 26 and on, well, 24 and on, he speaks about the Telz Yeshiva, how it had a, this would never happen. In fact, when they wanted to move Stern College to the YU campus, the Rosh Yeshiva went crazy. He talks about the Telz campus, which had the Yeshiva 400 students. But also what you had there was a seminary for women teachers, a religious girls' school, the Yavna, the Yavna school, the Machina preparatory school. Tells in Europe was considered very liberal, very moderate. They taught Ivrit. There was a Mechina. There was a Yavna, which is like a modern Orthodox type school. You had a girls' seminary. That's why Revolt said that the Tells in Cleveland, he said, it's not the real Tells. Because Tells, for years, was the only yeshiva that refused to allow you to go to college. Maybe Lakewood also, but Tells was known for that. Chaim Berlin, Tor Vadasi, went to college at night. Tells, you were not allowed to. I know someone who ended up getting a doctorate. Some of you might know who I'm referring to, but he never went to college. I don't know how he got in to get the doctorate, but he says because of Tells. So on page 26, he talks about learning in Tells. And who was his chavrusa? None other than Revolt. And remember what I said last week. I cited the memoir of Shemariyahu Shulman, that Revolt was regarded in Tells as the greatest, greater than the Rosh Yeshiva, the people who would later become the Rosh Yeshiva. That is, he quoted one of the old Tellsers there, who sat on the Mizrach. He says, no, none of the Yeshiva students, but if it was anyone, it would be Revolt. He was regarded as the greatest of the Talmidim there. So he tells a few stories with Revolt. One of the stories says that during Ben Hazmanim, he wanted to go on vacation to the summer resort Palanga, where yeshiva students would go. So what did Revolt say to him? Ben Hazmanim? What does Ben Hazmanim mean? It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as Ben Hazmanim. Let's stay here and study. And he says, because of Revolt's great influence on me, I gave up the idea of a holiday, and I stayed with him, and I studied with Revolt. He says that Revolt would study even in the interval between the Siddurim. And even after Meiriv, he went later. So that's about Revolt. On page 27, he tells a story and even mentions the name Joseph Levitin, who became rabbi in Mitau in Latvia. I don't know if he was martyred in the Holocaust, but he tells a story that he says Joseph Levitin was the senior student who had undertaken to tutor me when I began my studies at the yeshiva, because those who came from Germany, there's a whole group who came from Germany to study in the East European yeshivas. I discussed this in between Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy. So he's studying with the senior student. One day during a study period, he showed me a picture of a lovely looking girl and said, this is my future wife. What do you think of her? Then he says, I was stunned. Secular literature was out of bounds at the Tells Yeshiva. And here, not to mention pictures of girls, yet here he carried a picture of his future wife. So in a previous class, I told you how the Nazir, he was separated from his fiancée because she couldn't get out of Russia, and he made his way to Eretz Yisrael. To keep him faithful to his fiancée, that his mind was on her, he kept a picture of his fiancée's picture on his shtender, on his desk, all those years that he was in Jerusalem. And then if you remember the story I told, when she finally makes it out of Russia and gets her way to Eretz Yisrael, gets to Jerusalem, wouldn't you know it, he was on a Tani's Dibur. He was on one of his Tani's Diburs. So he couldn't even talk to her. So they had to convene a Beis Din right there to be matur him for all these years he hasn't seen his fiancée. And the one day she comes, he's in a Tani's Dibur. I remember saying, we did the classes on the Nazir probably 10 years ago, that today in yeshiva circles, this would be regarded as postished, inappropriate, and picture of your fiance. But if you read it, you see, I mean, you see, hear the stories about it, how pure this is, and there's nothing wrong with this. And you cannot get more of a holy person as the Nazir. Okay. Enough with, there's obviously I could say more about Revolt, but because his sefer has all sorts of interesting things, but we need to move on because we have, as always, great stuff to talk about. So we finished the letters, the 21 letters I published in Chakira. And as I told you, there's one letter which I gave them. It was in the original article, and they sent the article back minus that letter. Now, the reason they didn't publish the letter is, so I'm told, that it's not complete. You're going to see we only have the first page of it, although the first page of it is significant enough to me because it completely, what's the Chinese term, upshogs everything that's been said about the Rav in this area. So that's significant. Second of all, and also they told me that all the letters which I published are, and I'll pull up the letter a second for you. All the letters I published are hashkafa letters, letters, ideas. And this is halacha letter, and it shouldn't be, they didn't think it fit to being together. And okay, maybe they're they're very open-minded like Kira. It's not because of the position you're going to see from the Rav is too liberal and is not in line with what the Mishnah Berurah tells us or what Shemira Shabbos Kolchasa tells us. That's not the reason. That's not the way Chakira operates. That's not the way tradition operates. And now, I can tell you that years ago, this was absolutely the way tradition operated. Maybe I should review it now. I've now started writing again for them, or at least one article. I stopped writing for them because of they censored. They censored, or they wanted to censor an article I wrote, quoting Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook because it didn't reflect well. Well, I said, I'll say it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, I quoted him as saying in an article that the Chazon Ish is not the Gadol Hador. My father's the Gadol Hador. That's what he said. It's well known he said it. And I have the source. And they refused to put Printis because they said that it'll come off as knocking the Chazon Ish. First of all, I don't think it's knocking the Chazon Ish. But second of all, so what? And if he's entitled to say that his father's the Gadol Hador, not the Chazon Ish. So after that, I said, so it was like, last piece, I think, was 97, so it took 25 years till I came back. So there was a time that tradition would engage in all these sorts of censorship, but not okay, that's not the reason for Chakira. So let me explain before we see the letter what's going on here. Cooking on Shabbos. How do we cook on Shabbos? Well, if you've been to yeshiva or if you've looked in the various forum or go online. Oh, before I even talk about it, who's this letter addressed to? This letter is addressed to this individual. His name is Rabbi Irwin Hout, the late Rabbi Irwin Hout, the husband of Rivka Hout, who's very much involved in the Aguna issue. He wrote a couple books here, Divorce and Jewish Law and Life. He also wrote another book I'll show you in a second. The family, I spoke, contacted his daughter, email. They don't have the second page of the letter either. He wrote this book, The Talmud as Law or Literature. For a number of years, he was, Greg Halivni used to give shiur, and he would go to his shiur, or his class, I guess his class, just like Dr. Ari Bergman did, if you know who that is. And then he wrote this booklet. I don't know, maybe 100 pages. I have it over here. The Talmud as Law or Literature, in which it's an analysis of Halivni's approach, and he picks selected sugyas, shows what Halivni's trying to do, and he has a whole discussion there of this issue that we spoke about a number of times. Can you interpret the Mishnah different than the Gemara, which is what Halivni does? So I picked it up, this book up years ago at a used book sale. I mean, I don't. In fact, if I look right now on that page, Amazon, you can buy one used for $50. But it's a little soft. It's a soft cover book. I don't think it's you want to do that. But maybe someone has a PDF of it. It's a very interesting book. Okay, so on Shabbos, this is what we're usually taught, that you don't return cooked food to the stove. That is, you can't, Shabbos morning, you can't take food out of the refrigerator and return it to the stove or the oven, even if the food is cooked. Now, if the food is cooked, you can't, there's no bishul achar bishul, and even if it's not hot enough, like let's say the oven's 200, you're not cooking something, it'll just get warm, you still can't. So why not? Well, there's a dispute about it. Two opinions, either because it looks like cooking, or because they said you might stoke the coals to heat it up. And even if you don't hold like it's a problem of stoking the coals or turning up the heat or anything like that, because there is a position that's already cooked, we're not choshesh of turning up the heat because it's already cooked. There's still this problem that it appears as if it's cooking. So you can't stick it in an oven. That's sometimes I saw a tshuva on this by someone who says, let's say you're at a house. Sometimes people don't know the halacha, or they grew up differently and they put it in the oven. Can you eat it? And the answer is yes. We see held you can still eat it because although they're not supposed to put it in the oven, you can still eat it. I'm thinking you could ask. We have rabbis listening or others. There was an issue. A certain rabbi got up at an event where someone poured tea or coffee, whatever, and it was a cliche, and he made a big scene. No one's allowed to drink this. It's only a cliche, and someone said that, the host could have been very embarrassed, whatever, a case like that. I'm wondering, let's say you're in a house and someone gives it to you, because can you drink it in a cliche? Because the Rav quoted his grandfather as saying, Mishnah Berurah holds cliche. He said, my grandfather knew how to learn, and my grandfather knew how to learn, and he held that a cliche was enough. So although Chachilu, we don't rely on it, maybe b'diavad, cliche would be okay. Okay, so now, so then you can't get up in the morning, you can't put it in the, you can't even put it, although the Rav Avadia thinks you can put it just on the blech. But we always held or told that you can't put it directly on the blech. You have to put it on top, let's say, a pot or something else. Today they have something called the Kedera blech. And the Kedera blech, which are very popular, it's a blech, and then you have on top of that, you fill it with water, and then you put another metal piece on it. So it's called the Kedera blech. And when I bought mine years ago, it came with a piece of paper that this is approved by our official shelter. So around my town for years, everyone uses the Kedera blech. So I wanted to see a little bit about it. This is going to shock you. I'm glad you're sitting. Because who's the posek of the OU? Rav Schechter is the posek. He used to be Rav Schechter Rabelsky. Now it's Rav Schechter. I want to show you something here. I don't know how to make sense of this. This is what appears. The OU has on the OU site, warming food on Shabbos. Kedera blech. The Kedera blech is a rectangular covered shallow pan, which explains everything about the Kedera blech. And then it says, quote, it tells you why its proponents say it's mutter. However, the Kedera blech's use in this manner has been widely condemned by Rabbanim, because, as noted, the only reason one may warm up food on top of another pot of food is that doing so is odd and atypical. That reminds people not to raise the flame and isn't mistaken for cooking. And it goes on. In other words, the OU says, however, the Kedera blech is so unobtrusive, etc., etc., you shouldn't use it. The conclusion of the OU here is, they say first the Kedera blech that some permit, it's been widely condemned by Rabbanim. Capital R, Rabbanim, that is the real rabbis, why we condemn it, and this is why you shouldn't use it. How can the OU say this when their posek is the one who gave the permission for it, and this then was sold in all the Sorim stores and all the Judaica stores? Do they forget that its proponents is none other than the posek of the OU? So if anyone's involved in the OU, you please explain to me how this is possible, that they could. It would be one thing if they didn't say anything, they left it out. But to condemn the heter of their own posek, I don't understand it. So let's go on. Now, like I said, even if you hold that there's no issue of soaking the coals on food that's cooked already, you still have the problem of turning to the oven that it appears like it's cooked. Well, the Rav had a different position on this. The Rav's position, which was then adopted by NCSY, throughout Boston people use it. The Rav held like the Ron. If you go on there's a few sites that discuss this, a Halachapedia site, and I'll show you from Rabbi, forget his name, he published Halacha Positions of the Rav. I forget what book. I'll show you the page. He discussed it. Many people discuss it. There's a position of the Ron. Rav Nissim of Girona. We're not going to Girona this summer. God willing, next summer. The position of the Ron, based on the Yerushalmi, is that if food was on the fire, in the oven, let's say, Ben HaShmashos, once Shabbos already begins, then it can be returned on Shabbos morning without any of the conditions. The conditions we're told about, usually, that if you remove food from the blech, you have to be holding it, and it still has to be warm if you want to return it, that sort of thing. The Rav held that, in line with the Ron, that food that's in the oven or on the blech, not the Kedera blech, the regular blech, Ben HaShmashos, it can be put back in the refrigerator and brought, taken out again Shabbos morning and used. And this is what NCSY did. They NCSY would put food in the oven. And then they put it in the oven again Shabbos morning. This is what they did in Boston. Here, this is from the book Halacha Pesukim Rabbi Zigor. Halacha positions are Soloveitchik. Therefore, according to Rav Soloveitchik, one may take fully cooked solid food from the refrigerator and place it on the blech if the food was on the blech at the beginning of Shabbos after candlelight and Kabbalah Shabbos. You can read all about all the discussion of the Ran based on the Yerushalmi. And I mean, this is a well-known position of the Rav, so well-known that I knew it years and years ago because I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. At the time I met with him, I told you I had all these questions for him. I knew about this. This is known to be the practice in NCSY. I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, could I do this? And Halacha Maisa, I asked him, and he says, yes, 100%, Halacha Maisa, you could do this. So there's room. Who am I? I'm not a posek. I'm just saying where Varon said. But it appears to me, at least, there's room to be matter that if you want to leave food in the oven and then put it in Shabbos morning, relying on the Rav, I guess ask your local Orthodox rabbi, as they say. But that was what the Rav held. And there's one of the people who listened to us is from Boston. She told me that this was widely practiced in Boston. Now, if you look on the various sites that discuss the Rav's position, what they say, and this is Rav David Miller, who was my Rebbe in BMT, and many, many others, they say that the Rav only permitted reheating cooked solid foods. That's it, only solid foods, but not liquids. So the hitter I just told you about the foods in the oven, that's referring to things that are solid, that you can put it back in or on the blech, not kederbach or yerbach. That's solid, but not liquid. Okay, then we'll get into the question of what's, how much liquid is liquid? This is, if you have a little bit of gravy, is that a problem? Okay, not for me. It's not my area. But the general position is that you find everywhere. In fact, I've never seen in print anyone who says differently, that the Rav, all the people who discussed the Rav, Rabbi Jachter, I think, he discussed the Rav, I can't remember if he mentioned solid, but I've never seen anyone who says anything about liquid. From what I've seen, everyone repeats what Rav David Miller says, that it's only solid. So, before we see what the Rav says, so this is going to bring a stira, because you're going to have the Rav's own handwritings in a minute, plus what the Talmidim say. I don't know if the Talmidim ever heard this from the Rav, or they're just assuming this. But before I get to the Rav, I have to tell you about his mother, because you can't perhaps understand what the Rav is doing, maybe without knowing what his mother did. So now you're asking, his mother? What does his mother have to do? Well, first of all, there's... we all know about tradition, Masoras, but who's his mother? His mother is Rebbetzin Pesha Feinstein, the daughter of Rav Eliyahu Feinstein of Prujan, known as Rav Elia Prujaner. That's where the Rav was born, in Prujan. It's signed, if you remember, his doctoral dissertation he published as a book from Prujan. His first years were from Prujan. I guess that's his hometown, where his father was living at the... Well, no, his father wasn't living, but they, I guess his father was living. That's when he was still, before he had his first Rabbonus, I guess. She was a very interesting person. I'll show you something right now to show you that. But who was Rav Elia Prujaner? Rav Elia Prujaner was one of the Gedoli, really Gedoli Yisrael. His name is Feinstein. And everyone knows that the Rav is a cousin of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And everyone assumes that this is because their names are both Feinstein. Moshe's father's name is Feinstein, or Elia Feinstein. So therefore, Elia Feinstein's daughter. So that's they be related through the Feinstein. It's actually not true. The Rav Elia Prujaner was a Levi, and Rav Moshe Feinstein's family was Yisrael. The relationship is as follows. I always forget the relationship, so I had to look it up again today. You'll find it in the introduction to Igros Moshe, Volume 8, where the family tells you what the relationship is. So I'm going to read it, because I always forget this. I don't know why I forget it, but I always do. The mother of Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's the wife of Rav David Feinstein. His father's name was Rav David Feinstein. She was the sister-in-law. Rav Moshe's mother was the sister-in-law of Elia Feinstein, the Prujaner. That is, Rav Moshe's mother sister married Rav Elia Feinstein. So Rav Elia Feinstein was the uncle of Rav Moshe, but not on the Feinstein side, on his mother's side. So therefore, Rav Moshe and Pesha Feinstein, later Soloveitchik, were first cousins. Now she's known to be, she outlived her husband for many years. She's known to be a very special lady, very learned. I want to show you something here. You know this because in Rabbi Tenler's famous or infamous attack on the Jewish Observer, here it is. Let me enlarge this a little. Well, what did the Jewish Observer say in their so-called eulogy? It says, Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in the Polish town of Przyjaźń to Moshe Soloveitchik of Brisk and Rebbetzin Pesha, daughter of Rabbi Elia Feinstein. His primary teacher in Talmud was his father, while his mother provided him with a rigorous secular education. It's actually true. She, I wouldn't say provided him. She encouraged him to read all secular work. She was more open-minded than Rav Moshe. So what does Rabbi Tenler say? In discussing all the terrible things in this article, the great mother of the Rav, Rebbetzin Pesha, was a legendary tzaddikus whose Torah knowledge surpassed that of most rabbanim today. She is mentioned as the daughter of Elia Feinstein. Then he goes on, why is his nose that solid after that? So here he says that they make it seem as if Pesha Feinstein, she just knew how to read secular literature. And Rabbi Tenler says she's a great Talmud Chacham whose knowledge surpasses most rabbis today. Which is probably true. I told you in the past, I'm going to prove this in a future post, that despite Rabbi Tenler going crazy with that eulogy, so-called eulogy, really, you have to look at it just the opposite, that that was a very brave thing they did, because they went against the Rav Shach's command that there shouldn't be acknowledgement. So, leaving that aside. Okay, so why did I mention all this about Rebbetzin Pesha? Because, one more thing about Rav Elia. Rav Elia, although he's not a Brisker, he's the subject of one of the famous or infamous, if you like, stories in Halachic Man. Let me read it to you. This is, he says as follows, the Rav. When the Vilna Gaon's brother died, and the Gaon learned of it on the Sabbath, when mourning of Avos is forbidden, he did not display any emotion or signs of grief. After the Sabbath, when he concluded the Havdalah, he burst into tears. So that's the Gra. The beloved daughter of Rav Elia Prizhna took sick about a month before she was to be married. Rav Eliyahu went into his daughter's room and asked the doctor how much longer it would be until the end. When he received the doctor's reply, Rav Eliyahu returned to his room, removed his Rashi tefillin, and quickly put on the tefillin prescribed by Rabbeinu Tam. For immediately upon his daughter's death, he would be an onin. And when you're an onin, you're not going to wear tefillin. After he removed his second pair of tefillin, wrapped them up and put them away, he entered his dying daughter's room in order to be present at the moment his most beloved daughter of all would return her soul back to its maker. Now, this passage, in general, these passages, these stories are of great interest. And we've spoken in the past about some of these passages, what to make of it. The famous passage where the Baal Tokeya, the Chabad Baal Tokeya, who gets emotional, Rosh Hashanah, or Moshe Soloveitchik tells him, do you get emotional when you take a luv? Why are you emotional when you blow shofar? And we've spoken about the problems with this, and Ruchnesin said, and there's even an article in the Sholem Karmi Jubilee volume I'm holding it right now by Alex, I think his name is pronounced Studen, S-Z-T-U-D-E-N, Studen, I guess. Why are there stories in Halachic Man? Now, he refers to an article by David Hartman, who discusses this very story. And here's this. I just read you the story. And this is what Hartman said. There is something abnormal, one might even say inhuman, about Revelia's behavior. One would normally expect a father to want to be with his daughter in her final moments. When a child is dying, one would not expect a father to worry about such questions as, what mitzvot will I be able to perform when my status changes to a mourner? Will I be able to put on my second pair of tefillin? One would expect a father to be engrossed entirely by his immediate tragedy. Nevertheless, Soloveitchik regards Revelia as a paradigm of a halachic man. His reaction to his daughter's death exemplifies, quote, great strength and presence of mind. Now, and then, so Hartman continues along that. Student picks up with this. He actually mistakenly says that it's Avishai Margalit who refers to, in the text, as inhuman, when truly it's he mentions Margalit, but it's David Hartman. And Sudan makes an interesting point. He says that it's only inhuman, he says, if you read the story the way Reuven Ziegler, who we, in the previous passage, he discusses how Reuven Ziegler, who's an expounder of the Rav's Torah. The Rav, in this passage, according to Ziegler, is showing that halachic men were able to renounce their grief and replace it with joy. And that's why the Gaon and Revelia displayed no emotion, because halachic men can completely remove their emotions this way. I guess like Spock or something. The student thinks this is a mistake. He says there's another way to read the story that preserves halachic man's humanity. He says that when it comes to the Gaon, the Rav did not say, the Rav wrote that he did not, quote, display any signs of grief. And he says, what the Rav is telling you, that he felt the grief, he just didn't express it. And he says that according to the halacha on Shabbos, you're allowed to have inner grief. It's just outer grief. So there's no halachic reason on Shabbos, student says, for the Grod not to have any inner grief. And he says the same considerations apply to Revelia, who was under no obligation to forsake his grief. Rather, the power of the story derives precisely from the fact that in the midst of his intense grief, Revelia nevertheless displayed tremendous presence of mind. Despite his grief, Revelia exhibited rare devotion to the mitzvah of tefillin. He did not replace his intense inner grief. He mastered it. So what student says, he asks, is halachic man stoical, almost inhuman? And he says the answer depends on how you read the passage. Does Rav Elia renounce his grief, or does he sublimate it? And student argues, it's really like a revisionist interpretation. As far as I know, everyone until student argues that the point of the story is that a halachic man is able to remove grief entirely through the halacha. And student argues differently. And student agrees with Hartman that if you understood it the way most people understand it, that it would be inhuman, which I think is problematic, because that means that student, if you're wrong, then and odds are you are wrong only because everyone else thinks differently, there's certainly a possibility you're wrong, then you're forced to conclude that the Gra and Revelia and others were inhuman. I think it's easier to conclude that they're different than us, and they're different madrigas. They relate to things. We can't even begin to understand how they relate to certain matters like this. And the problem I have with students reading is that, well, what about the other stories? What about Ramosha's response to the Baal Tokeya? You can't touch it the way you just did here. So I like to leave these as teku, that this is the, you know, these are different types of people who respond differently. Listen, this, I can tell you stories about Revelvel Soloveitchik. I mean, he was very Spock-like, lacking complete, removing emotion, letting halacha determine everything. When he had a young child die before 30 days, and his wife was crying, and Revelvel said, "There's no avelos before 30 days. How could you can't cry?" That's exactly in line with the Rav's description here. It's not sublimating your grief. It's removing your grief and allowing halacha to determine everything. So I, with all due respect, and I like the article very much, but I think the read is incorrect, because I don't think, and that's not what the hagiography about the Vilna Gaon presents these stories. They present it precisely that halacha, just like we saw, remember I quoted you from the Rosh Hashiva of Tells, Rabbi Bloch, that halacha creates facts. The idea is that halacha creates determines whether you have emotions or not. It's not like us, where we have emotions and halacha. For the halachic man, there is no such thing as an emotion outside the halacha. The halacha creates the emotion. So by definition, there isn't grief. at a time when the halakha says there is no grief. They don't have the same sort of emotions like we do. Now, he does make a good point that on Shabbos, which is the story of the Gra, then you're allowed to have inner grief, but that story doesn't apply to Revelio. So now let me tell you what why I mentioned this and why she's important to the story, to the halachic discussion we're going to have. And there's a few sources I can cite for this. Well, let me cite one source. Here's the book I showed you before, Yelid Shashuim. It's actually an English book, but there's more Hebrew than English, or at least no, probably about the same. No, a little more English I see than Hebrew. More English. It's a biography and a study of his ideas and all sorts of stuff in it of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Well, it doesn't, it's by his son. His son, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik in the Old City. So I want to read you something now from page 30. It has a picture here. I don't know if you can see it well, but there you have a picture of Repesha Soloveitchik, Shmuel Soloveitchik in the middle. That's the Rav's brother, who's a chemistry professor at YU, and Ramosha on the other side. You can also find the picture online at the dais, where you have Rebbetzin Pesha and Ramosha sitting together. Notice they're all sitting on the dais. It's not women in another room or behind a machitza or anything like that. So let me read you this book, by the way, is the second edition. The first edition I've showed you as well was thought too hot to handle, and it was removed from circulation. I've showed you in the past. But let me read you. And pay attention, this is Rebbetzin Pesha. It doesn't say whether she got this from her father. I mean, she grew up in a house with one of the Gedolei Yisrael. You wonder, would she on her own do something that she didn't see in her own house? Because if her father didn't do it, she's going to do something. It's unfortunately, we can't determine this, but maybe she's such a person that she could come up with things. By the way, before I get to what I'm going to read you, he tells some stories here about Rebbetzin Pesha. She even gives some lumdas here. Once he says, Rav Aaron said that during Havdalah, for whatever reason, she didn't hear the bracha, Borei Pri HaGafen. She heard the other bracha, but maybe, I don't know, maybe like when he said bracha, a noise went off or she wasn't paying attention. So she said, nevertheless, I didn't hear the bracha on Borei Pri HaGafen. She said, I'm still Yotzei Havdalah. Why? Because she said that the bracha on Borei Pri HaGafen is not a chelak of Havdalah. It's just part of Birkas Nenin that we say because we have to drink from the kos, but it's not essential to the Havdalah. And therefore you say the Borei Pri HaGafen in order you can drink something. But Kiddush on Shabbos, she says the bracha of Borei Pri HaGafen is not just Nenin, that's Chelak of the Kiddush. So if you actually didn't hear the bracha of the Kiddush, the Borei Pri HaGafen at the end, let's say you only heard the first part, not the last part, then you're not Yotzei, and then you have to hear it. So here you see Rebbetzin Pesha with real lumdus. And he quotes other things, very positive things about her. But listen to this. Rebbetzin Pesha would place cold soup on the hot Shabbos blech and be careful to remove the soup before it became Yatzo Edisbo. She was not concerned about the Isser Chazara because the Psak of the Ramah is that if the food was on the Shabbos Blech for the duration of the Bein HaShemoshos on Friday night and was later removed from the Shabbos Blech, there is no Isser Chazara. The Ramah quotes this view of the Ran, and he says that we're nohik to follow the Ran, but it's better not to. The problem is that the Ramah says, but even the position of the Ran that we follow, it's only if it hasn't been completely cold. That is, you could take it off the black. You don't need to hold it, anything like that. You can put it down completely and then put it back. He says we follow. But he says, the Ramah says, if it's completely cold, you don't do that. So I think I have a problem with this explanation as to why they're saying this, because this doesn't really fit the Ramah. It fits the Ran. It doesn't fit the Ramah. Again, the Ramah, I'm not sure whether he's trying to read the Ran that way, but that's not the Pshat in the Ran. Then he says, the only question then is whether it is forbidden from the standpoint of Isser Bishul. Rebbetzin Pesha reasoned, she can reason, that it is permitted to do this on the basis of Sfek Sveka. First of all, there's a Machlokas Rishonim As to whether a liquid, we say, Ein Bisho Achar Bisho. The view of the Chacham Yisrael is that even with liquid, we say, Ein Bisho Achar Bisho. Seika number one. Seika number one. But in this case, one removes the soup from the Shabbos Blech before it reaches the Hida Bisho. In other words, so we're not even allowing it. We're removing it before Yatzel let us bow. The soup becomes only lukewarm. There's a Machlokas Rashi and Tosos whether this is permitted. Or whether this is an Asur Durabanan, because you might forget that it might be going to Bishol. The question revolves around an Asur Durabanan. Rebbetz and Pesha, therefore, reason that it's permitted on the basis of sex. So here you see that Rebbetz and Pesha heated up cold soup on Shabbos to get it warm, something that we're always told you're not allowed to do. So now let me see. Rabbi Bitzal Naor, he also cites this. It says in Orah Mizrach 51, he cites this as having heard this from Rav Soloveitchik. Oh, no, sorry, from Yosef Soloveitchik. This book is written by Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, sorry. Not Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik in Jerusalem. He also cites this from Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. He cites something else. He cites also a story that Rav Chaim said. If Rebbetzin Pesha was a man, Ilmale Haita Gever, Aisa Godo Hador. If she would have been the Godo Hador, I think he means because she would have had a chance to learn. She was able to pick up things, but she wasn't going to have a chance really to learn Gemara seriously. Rabbi Naor mentions at her funeral, which took place at YU, her. It was reported that she did not miss a mincha in her life. And also, and oh, this I already knew, that in Espadin they said that she did not rely on the heter of the Bach, that in Chutz La'aretz we eat chadosh. Okay, so let me show you the Rav now. And this is going to completely overturn, it's going to be in line with Repesha, and it's going to overturn everything we saw that the Rav was only speaking about salad. Here's the letter. Notice how the Rav signs his name at the top, Dalid Vav Bet. That's going to be important when we get to the so-called letter to Meir Kahana. So this is 1959. Dear Rabbi Hout, acknowledge receipt of your letter. One, we don't know how many questions were asked, but we have this one. Liquids which were cooked or boiled before the Sabbath and remained on the covered gas range during the Ben HaShemoshos period, may be put back after being removed for the night to the refrigerator on the covered flame on Saturday morning, provided that the liquid foods do not reach the temperature of Yad Soletz. In other words, here you see the Rav saying exactly what his mother did, and this is the viewpoint of the Ran. This is the viewpoint of the Ron with solid foods. I really don't know if the Ron also held liquid foods. I'm not really holding in the sugya, but it's a kal vachomer that if you can do it with a liquid, you could do it with solid. So I'm not sure whether this is relying on the Ron or this is because if you notice what I just read you, they gave a different explanation for this. But this is the idea we're talking about. You could take it out. If, however, the liquids are kept near the flame so that their temperature remains above the house temperature, we do not have to concern ourselves with the aspect of Yad Soletz. So this is a complete halachic answer, number one. That was the first question he was asked. The second question he was asked was about a blech. All we see here are the words, I would advise you to put a tin or tinfoil cover on the, it's going to be on the, I don't know what it's referring to, the stove or a pot or whatever it is. We don't know. But at least we have the first one. And this is exactly what I just read you from Rebbetzin Pesha Soloveitchik, and it's in line. Although the liquid always adds an interesting angle because the liquid has different halachic issues than solid, but it's in line with the larger position of the Rav that things taken off the stove and put in the refrigerator that were on the stove or in the oven even, Ben HaShemoshos can be removed. I don't even know if in Boston anymore they still follow the Rav's position or what NCSY does, but this for years. This is what NC Swai used to do and they used to do in Boston as well. So that's the letter that was not published. We'll have to discuss about that later. And I think it's significant because it shows that the common expressed position that the Rav did not allow removing anything from the refrigerator, that's not true. If it's liquid, only if it's solid, it's not true, as we see here. And is this the Rav's position, or is it he's just following his mother? I guess he grew up maybe with this, so he's not gonna. I mean, he grew up in his house, perhaps. So maybe this is what he was served every Shabbos. I don't know, but it's not in line with the general practice. Now I think it's time. I'll get to the questions for next class. I had it all prepared for today. Let me show you quickly. We're going to get into another fascinating thing, namely this letter of the Rav to President Chaim Herzog defending Meir Kahana. And already you can see how it's signed, Yosef Dov, Dalet Vet. Forget the signature. We'll talk about the signature next time. The Rav never signed his name, Dalet Vet. It was always Dalet Vav Vet. Take a look at any example. But we will talk about this letter. This letter, which was published on the Sfarim blog, it shook the world. And I feel a little bit of pride being involved with the Sfarim blog, because this became so much so that the Rosh Yeshiva Moshe Lichtenstein had to write an entire piece on the Sfarim blog, which we'll analyze, about the forged letter of Soloveitchik. And we'll talk about that. Is it a forged letter? And if it is, who would have done it? And what was the Rav's position about Meir Kahana? So we'll analyze all this next week. I think it's even more relevant today because, the Kahana viewpoint seems to be coming back into either the full Kahana viewpoint or partial, coming back into certain of our circles. Before I start, I have a note here to see something. Let me see if I. One more thing from Yelet Shel Shu, and then I'll take the questions. This is on page 28. These are one of these stories that I don't know. There's other stories like this in the first edition that are removed and are not in here, but this was kept in. When my mother was very elderly, she broke her hip. That's Rav Aaron speaking about Rav Depesha. She broke her hip and was confined to bed for several weeks. Hagaon Rav Yitzchak Kuttner came to me, Mevaker Chola, my mother, and he stayed for over an hour. This is actually from a letter that Rav Aaron wrote in 1992. Before he left my mother's house, Rabbi Kuttner turned to me and said, Rav Aaron, I stayed for over an hour. We were reminiscing lethargic memories. Your mother did all the talking, and I was gazing at your mother's eyes. And don't be choshed me that I was over chas v'shalom on the iser of istakus benashim. It's very strange for a woman to say that about an older woman. It is a mitzvah to gaze at your mother's eyes because your mother's eyes radiate kedusha. Her, of course, did not imply that everyone was on this madrega to see kedusha. So that's a letter there. Let me take the questions now. Thomas says, would the candle blessing be anti-kari? That's the general assumption, that the Gaonim instituted this as an anti-Karaite measure, and then it was picked up. But the significant point is that everyone picked it up, and there aren't even any pockets, even though you had among the Rishonim some who said, shouldn't say the bracha, or at least not the bracha with Shem Hashem. It became universally accepted. The bracha on candles for Yom Tov, that the Ammonites do not say it. As far as I know, everyone else does make the bracha of the candles on Yom Tov, except if Rav Schechter doesn't actually. But that's for a different reason, because of the if you have a light on, let's say today we have lights on in the house, and the second day of Yom Tov, he won't say the well, not only won't say the bracha, he won't light it. So it's not that he won't say the bracha, he won't light it, because we already have light. Nissen says, despite the anti-college position of Tells, in the 1950s, Tells did recite Hatikvah at their yeshiva dinner. Yes. Well, hold on. This gets back to the they joined. Is it the Tells dinner? What they did is they joined with the Mizrahi. And Schachter, J.J. Schachter, published that the booklet, which showed that they came together with the Mizrahi for an event in honor of Israel. So it's not, I don't think, it's not their dinner. It's that
Thank you
they
for correcting me. But they did also change one word. Instead of saying Leot Am Hafshi, it was Leot Am HaTorah.
Okay. We have to look back. They joined together with Mizrahi for a day of honoring Israel. It's good to see Nissan. We were together in Washington, D.C. Wednesday. Someone privately says that... this is private information. Okay. I guess all I can conclude, since these are the only questions, and it's 9:31, is that the halachic discussions don't get as much analysis from our audience and comments as, I guess, what they call in yeshiva circles, the hak, the discussions, the history and all that. So we'll end here. And anyone who listens afterwards, if you have halachic angles, you need to point out, I'm certainly not a bookie in these areas of Hilchos Shabbos, but we'll get back to the Hak next week with the Rav and Meir Kahana. So Rabbi Kelman.
I'll ask you the comment.
Rabbi Kelman, I think we've been going in like 3 years, these Zoom classes. We have here like four comments and or five comments and one private. I don't think we've ever had this ever. Are afraid to speak about halacha.
I'll give you something you can talk about. I was reading on Shabbos. Yeah. I just got the issue of tradition on the Rav, came in the mail on Thursday. So I was reading it over Shabbos and I was blown. I thought it was so beautiful. Tova Lichtenstein's article about her mother, but Mrs. Yeah. Soloveitchik, which she writes, nobody knows anything about his mother. I assume you read the article and it was. I found it was so beautiful. And I commented, I mean, not that to make, you know, just the normalcy of how, of course, they raised the kids and the background and going to school and how she met her husband and the brothers were in school, et cetera, and how she would, they would go out the family to the beach.
Well, swimming. She would take them to go swimming. Yeah.
Right. Really, you haven't said it. I thought it's a beautiful article. Tova Lichtenstein writing about her mother. She called Mrs. Soloveitchik, of course, because that's how she was known, even though she was, you know, Dr. Soloveitchik and how my money the school ran and et cetera, et cetera. So if you wanted to comment, but I'm commenting on it. If you haven't seen it, please get a hold of it.
Yes, I also think it's interesting. We know people who knew Nikki and Daniel from Onset knew Mrs. Soloveitchik. Many knew her, but they knew her in the 50s and 60s. Here you see, you get what she was like in the third, well, even before, Tova was born. But, you know, as Tova, as a 10-year-old girl, her mother taking her to learn to swim. And, we don't know when, I don't think we have anyone listening to us who knew her when, she was a young mother. And so you get insights from, when she wasn't always, she'd have to stay home in Boston when the Rav would go to New York. So unless you grew up in Boston and you're of that age to have known her, and it's very nice. And obviously a child can tell about the parent. I also think it's significant that she said in an interview that she gave about this article to Jeffrey Sachs, she said, first of all, she thought it was important to speak about her mother. But Tova Lichtenstein said, she tells, everyone thinks in the modern Orthodox world, you always have to cite the Rav. Everything has to be the Rav. And she's very opposed to that. She said her father would be very opposed to it. Of course, he studied the Rav, but the idea that he has a veto and that everything has to be through his angle, Tova's very insistent, saying that don't think that every article you write has to bring the Rav in here, the Rav in there. You know, even modern Orthodoxy is much broader than just the Rav. And you see, she doesn't want it to become a cult of the personality or of the ideas of her father. Of course, she knows who her father is and she recognizes it.
To be fair about that, who else?
And her father, her son, Rav Meir writes that he writes about the difference in the book Mentor of Generations, the difference between a chassid and a student, that he used to be a chassid. When he was young, he was a chassid of his grandfather. But then he became a student. And what it meant to be a student of the Rav is to have an independent mind. So Rav Meir says, I see things sometimes differently than my grandfather. Yes, sorry. What did you want to say, Mark?
To be fair, the reason everybody cites the Rav is that the fraction of stuff that he wrote relative to what other people of that mindset would write is so much huger.
Yeah, and I think so. I think you're right, and I think it's becoming even broader, but there's also a sense. This is what Jeffrey Sachs says. He's the editor. that people send in articles and they feel they need to always come back to the Rav or cite something. And her point was that you don't need to do that. She told that Jeffrey Sachs when he became editor, that don't, you know, don't turn him into a Rebbe, that everything needs to come back to him. He's not a serious Rebbe.
What's happened?
Yeah, so it has. So she's fighting against it. Stavka Tova fighting against that, turning her father into a Rebbe. He never was a Rebbe. He never wanted to be treated as a Rebbe in the sense, because when he's a Rebbe, all of a sudden, then everything he says, you have to follow. He wanted you to question, to understand. And and someone privately says, the Chakira article by Rabbi Muskin, When Unity Reigns, Chakira 2012. There you'll find the document about... So even tells that it became more extreme, that they were able to be something that today you wouldn't be able to imagine, to take part with the Mizrahi together. It was a different era. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, thank you for that.
Yeah, I think also that's the basis of Rav Elia Meir Bloch's, you know, famous letter, was when he was criticized. I think it was 1956, and Rabbi Muskin from L.A., his father was the rabbi in Cleveland, where the program was holded, and they have the whole thing printed. It's very beautiful. And the Rav Elia Meir Bloch, the Rosh Yeshiva in Tells, was heavily criticized. And he writes the letter that saying, you know, you have to read it. It's also a beautiful letter that there are three mitzvot the yeshiva world doesn't do, because the reform and the Haskalah took it over, that is speaking in Hebrew, learning Tanakh, and living in Israel. And he said, just because the reform does it, doesn't mean we shouldn't. I'm sure, of course, you're well aware of that letter, I'm sure. But
we've spoken about it in the past. We've spoken about it.
But anyways, that I think is printed in that article in Chakira, if I remember.
I don't remember the details of it, but I'll check it out. I remember we went through that article in a previous class when I spoke about Tells, what they had in Europe, how they were the modern yeshiva in Europe. Right. Okay, thank you. This is great.
Okay. Thank you. Tomorrow, of course, continuing our regular scheduling, Dr. Sokolow on the songs of the Chalutzim and Rabbi Shulman on Sefer Daniel. Those are pretty opposite shiurim. But anyways, okay, welcome to both. And shiurim Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, every day. And we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend. And everybody be well. Shavuot Tov. You know, it's Monday night, but still, I haven't seen many of you since before last Shabbos. So anyway, be well, and Laila Tov, everybody.
Thank you. Ma, Laila Tov.
Makasha.
Kol Tov.